Welcome to Speak for Yourself from the Crib, presented by Hyundai. Marcellus Wiley, joined by LeVar Arrington, Bucky Brooks. It's been a tumultuous week in America, and we've got a lot to say about it. As we all saw, the nation was rocked by protests from coast to coast this weekend, with demonstrators taken to the streets so the world could hear their anger and sadness over the death of George Floyd. Most of the protesters came in peace, but violence erupted in many cities, and most of it appeared to be started by agitators or looters who had nothing to do with the protests. Needless to say, it was one of the most turbulent weekends in American history. LeVar, what's your reaction to what happened?
Yeah, Marcellus, I mean, I got mixed emotions. First is raw feelings about everything that has taken place and has transpired. Obviously, the tragedy of what took place to lead to the reasoning behind having these protests. But I was encouraged. I was encouraged at the unity. I was encouraged at how much buy-in there was, the response. I mean, there were protests taking place worldwide surrounding this whole topic of Black lives mattering and just having social justice. So I was encouraged by that, Marcellus. But I also got to say, you mentioned the looting and the chaos that took place. I understand violence takes place sometimes when change is taking place because it's uncomfortable. But there's a difference between clashing with peaceful protesters and something breaks out versus people breaking into sneaker shops and food shops and stores, grocery stores, different things like that. I just felt like it became a narrative that created confusion. And a lot of times what we do understand is when you're fighting for something that's socially justice involved, people are always looking for justification to say why it didn't work or why it shouldn't have happened. I was just disappointed that you have people that did not keep the main topic of conversation and the main focus of what these protests were for in the forefront.
Yeah, LeVar, I agree with you. Like, it was disappointing to see that aspect of it, the looting, the stealing, the violence that broke out. But I'm going to kind of focus on what I thought was positive about the weekend. And I felt like watching young people, the young athletic world, the young athletes, the generation that we have poked and prodded for years to have our athletes be involved and be activists and take advantage of their platforms. Well, we saw that happen. And the thing that was really beautiful about it wasn't just Black people talking. We saw all kinds of people speaking up and taking a part. And I think the big tipping point and where we're beginning to see change, we saw young and bold athletes from Southern schools, Joe Burrow, Trevor Lawrence, coming from LSU and Clemson, respectively, speaking out before their coaches even spoke out. To me, that is when the change begins to happen, when people on the outside, people that aren't directly involved, that don't necessarily feel the pains of the community, come out and speak about it. That's when we're beginning to have the kind of change that we want to have. And those guys speaking out and others who have big platforms who don't necessarily look like us, when they take the mantle and they begin to point the light on some of the injustices that are happening across the country, that's when we will begin to have to make real progress. And I think it was a huge step forward this weekend.
Yeah, guys, I mean, such a bag of mixed emotions if you talk about what's happening in America again. And unfortunately, we've all heard this before. We've all seen this before. We've all felt this before. I'm really privileged to be on the show with you guys right now, a brother from the East Coast and in Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh, and a brother from the South, North Carolina and Raleigh. All different experiences, but understanding what is keeping us feeling that same commonality of a broken promise of equality from America. And no matter if that broken promise comes in the complexion of racism or some people feel like an opportunity, you saw all types of people out there, Black, white, old, young, all coming with the collective spirit of pain, of anguish, It wasn't just a collective chant and protesters, but there was a collective pain that we all saw. And it's interesting to see the protesters sit there in a peaceful manner. And then we saw also the rioters and the looters who had more destruction on their mind than the purest of intentions. But this is the situation that has come to a head once again in this country as an ugly reminder that the playing field still isn't level as promised. And when will we get to that day? I tell everyone all the time, growing up, for me, my father used to tell me how evil always came in disguise. And it could come in a different color, shape, form, uniform, but it's always evil. And if you understand what that means in terms of how it affects your life, we're starting to realize that we're dealing with a dynamic that is before us, and unfortunately, is still with us. And we need to make some changes. So, LeVar, as you see all of these things happening right now, talk about those deeper emotions that you felt in your experiences.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you talk about the complexities of racial relations and how that works, it's always going to be a complex conversation because one side understands it from the experience of it, and while the narrative and the conversation with other people is you have to help them to understand what they don't get and what they don't understand. I agree with Bucky on the quotes and the speaking out from Lawrence and from Burrow. I finally feel as though the message is starting to become much clearer. I'm finally starting to feel as though the understanding of what this anger and what this pain and what the frustration that you see playing out so many times is really representation of. This is not a mythical feeling. It's not a hidden, you know, feeling of insecurity or lack of relevance. It's a reality that we face every single day. And so for me, the one thing that I felt coming out of yesterday and the protests as of late, and maybe it's because of the amount of exposure that can come from different platforms and the voices can be heard and not be muffled or manipulated to sound differently. I think that we are going to, for the first time in all of these historical moments of time of frustration and anger and outrage, I really am hopeful and I truly believe that we are going to have a much better dialogue as to how we move forward. And a lot of it, I believe, will be led by athletes. And it's a time for athletes to really stand up and impose their will and their influence on platforms that are so amazingly set up to make a difference in these moments.
Yeah, LeVar, I completely agree with you. I think what we're seeing is a different level of humanity being expressed. And I think, obviously, what has come out of the pandemic has really, everyone has been home. So everyone has been forced to kind of take a pause, and we've been able to consume more videos and see what is going on. Where in the last 2 or 3 months, we've seen a number of instances that have kind of shown up and popped up on our radar. And so now you're seeing these athletes like J.J. Watt and Carson Wentz speak up to some of the things that they're seeing and begin to really understand and relate and empathize with some of the issues that blacks have been talking about in and inside and outside of the locker room. And so, look, sometimes you have to take a step or two back before you can make progress and go forward. And I think this weekend showed us that more people are willing to engage in the discussion, more people are willing to kind of pick up the ball and run with it and have the conversation and try and carry it over the line. And the more people that we get having open and honest dialogue and conversations, that's when we will begin to see some of the progress that we all want to see.
Exactly. I mean, let's just be real about this, guys, that despair's destination is destruction. You got to understand, when your reality, every single day, you go through an existence where you feel distant and disconnected from the values of your society, you hear the message, but you don't feel the love. And you get to a place where you start to make that risk-reward conversation in terms of, what do I have to lose? And what a horrible place to be in terms of mentality. But there is a reality. I've been in that place before, man. It's crazy growing up. My grandmother used to tell us the stories of yesteryear. And my grandmother was in Watts, California. And after the Watts riots of 1965, moved our family to greener pastures for a better life. She moved our family from Watts to Compton, California. And my mother grew up in Compton, California, graduated from Compton High, had me at the age of 19, and had the same ambition, same aspiration, just to level that playing field, just desperate to live greater than her circumstances. Moved our family from Compton to South Central Los Angeles. Fast forward to 1992. I'm sorry, it looks so eerily similar to 2020. We had to go through the riots of LA. Same despair, same issues, the same discouraging feeling where you hear those principles, but you want to feel those values and feel valuable. And that's where we are. We're in a situation where we're hearing a lot of conversation about this, but it needs to materialize into something that can actually make the people who feel like they have been left behind on the lowest rung, who feel desperate, that they're being served as well, especially in confrontations as we're talking directly with the police, a public servant to serve and to protect you, not to inflict harm or create anxiety. And that's a situation that we're in right now. And it's so unfortunate, guys, that it's the same song, but it's a different day. Hopefully, what happened over the course of this week will make it a different day going forward. Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the Crib, Marcellus Wiley, joined now by LeVar Arrington and NFL longtime coach Eric Mangini. Let's head to college football, where there's a racial controversy brewing at Clemson. Earlier this week, Dabo Swinney made a statement about social justice in reaction to George Floyd's death. But afterward, a report surfaced that a few years ago, Swinney had not disciplined a white assistant coach, Danny Pierman, who had used the N-word during practice. Now, the player who was involved in the incident, former tight end DJ Greenlee, has explained what happened, saying, "It was just a heated argument during practice. Basically, me and the coach got into it, and I was speaking with one of my teammates. He heard me use the N-word, basically, and basically tried to correct me by saying the N-word back. He wasn't saying that I was a N-word. It was using the tone in a word like, okay, I was talking to my teammate and you came over here." A lot to unpack here, LeVar. What's your reaction?
I mean, my first reaction is it's unacceptable. You know, there are some things that sometimes are off limits, and this is one time where it is. As a coach, I understand trying to illustrate and teach. But these are still young men that have been entrusted in these men's hands by their parents. And just thinking about it from my perspective, if I were in that scenario, whether he was trying to teach me, make a point, or what have you, I just don't know how I would have reacted to that in that moment. So now that becomes a very serious moment of truth for the player and for the coach. If that player jumps on that coach and they got to break that up, chances are he gets kicked off of that team. It changes the trajectory of his career. What happens if he doesn't? Then obviously it doesn't get reported. It's looked at as maybe this is a coaching moment. I don't know, but I don't feel as though that's acceptable at any point in time to be a professional, to be a leader, and to be responsible over the young men that you're teaching and coaching and guiding.
Yeah, you know, when I saw this, my reaction was the same as LeVar. It's not acceptable in any context. And when it does happen and you read through the follow-up on it, he eventually apologized to the player and he apologized to the position group. But why wasn't this something that where he apologized to the whole team? Why wasn't this a moment for the whole team to talk about this. And if an issue is important, then you have to make it important. And it's definitely important enough to have that conversation in front of the whole team. The other reaction was, what would have happened if a player had done something to a coach, or had said something offensive to a coach, or a player had used an offensive term in general? What type of discipline would there have been? And then shouldn't there have been some discipline applied to this coach? Shouldn't he have been held to a higher standard because he is in that leadership position? And it's even different than the NFL. These are kids. In the NFL, there are more true adults. And in this situation, these are kids.
Inexcusable. One word, inexcusable. In a sport that we know it's all about action and response, I want to break it down to those two layers as well. The action is just inexcusable. But I think the response is really highlighting the real issue here. As we hear Coach apologize, and his apology rings hollow. In his apology, he says, I repeated a racial slur I overheard when trying to stop the word from being used. Wow. I understand sometimes coaches think two wrongs make it right. Let's mess it up to clean it up. That's how football coaches sometimes act and think. But this is not that opportunity, coach. And when you say that, all of a sudden, you get into a situation where your apology rings hollow, not only because of the words, but because of the crowd. As you said, Coach Mangini, this is a guy who only apologized to his small tight ends group. But it was said in front of the entire team. And never did he have to apologize in front of the entire team, nor did he. Or was he held accountable in front of the entire team? So when you hear that, LeVar, and knowing that it gets deeper than just the interaction and just that moment, what's your response?
You know, again, just looking at it from a personal standpoint, my mother went to school and was a school teacher, went to get her master's degree at Duquesne while teaching, worked several jobs to be able to provide and do the things that she did so that we would have fair opportunities. If this had came down the pipe and I called home, because you got to believe you're calling home. My mom, not my dad. My dad would have wanted to talk it out. But my mom, it would have been some smoke, some real smoke. So now, again, when something like this happens, if you don't decisively handle that issue, if you don't handle that with an iron fist, then now you're opening up yourself and you're susceptible. Even now, after years of it happening before, Dabo Swinney now has been opened up to some very, very real criticisms based off of his lack of action. I'm going to tell you right now, okay, there was no drama that came from it, but what if there were? What if that man's mother showed up and was irate with what was done and how it was handled? Does the kid now, because we all have been there, does the kid now slip on the depth chart? Does the kid now not be viewed as important as a player or a part of the society of that team? How does this change that young man's life? And what message mentally, emotionally is that sending to that young man that this was how it was handled? This is us moving on from it. It happened. It was a coaching error, a slip, but it was meant for your own good. It's time out. And I think we're at a point now in our society and culturally speaking, it's time out to turn a deaf ear to ignorance. It's time out to look at things and just say, oh, let's minimize it. It was a teaching moment, so I'm sorry, and let's move on from it. Well, if they made it a bigger deal, I think it's a bigger deal by the player, and it's a bigger implication for the player, and I don't find that to be right or correct at all.
And players understand what's important. And if as a coach you say, this is important, but you don't back it up with any action, you don't back it up with any time allocated to discussing it, to addressing it, then it's not really important. Those words ring hollow. And when you have something like this that happens in front of the whole team, but it never gets addressed in front of the whole team, it never gets resolved in front of the whole team, people don't get a chance to express themselves in that environment, then it's not really important. And what would you have done to a player if they had done something that the coaching staff found to be wrong, to be egregious? What would have happened to a player? And then why isn't the coach held to a standard that's even higher? Because you are in a position with kids. These are kids. And I know they're, you know, maybe you look at a football player and you think that they're not kids because of how big they are, but they're still impressionable young men that you have taken an oath and a responsibility to help educate and to help address issues with, and you're not holding up your end of the bargain.
Yeah, I want to be clear here. I stopped using the N-word 10 years ago, and I'm still around people that use the N-word frequently. And I get it. I'm not policing them. I let them know my slice of reality and where I'm coming from, and I allow them the freedom to do what they want to do after that conversation, which is always brief. But my issue is not that. My issue is how these football coaches will come into your living room and look your family in the eye and talk about the promotion of values and what their program stands for. And then when they take you away from that family, where's the enforcement of those same values? Or more so, where's the discipline when those values aren't upheld? And we look at this situation, it's just crazy how when you don't take ownership of your violation, if you're a Coach Pierman, guess what I don't believe? That you're contrite. No ownership. No contrition, because now it opens up Pandora's box. And guess what occurs then? The cover-up is worse than the crime itself. Now there are other stories coming out. The story of how Coach Dabo Swinney didn't allow the players or suggested to the players not to be a part of a sit-in because that sit-in would distract the team. 5 months before the season starts, he's worrying about a distraction to the team, or is it a distraction to his audience, his fan base, which is not trying to hear this conversation? So it's just interesting. You can put out all the tweets, all the responses, and talk about social justice on the platform of social media, but where it really needs to be focused on and enforced is on the platform of your practice and playing fields. Hopefully they get this one right and do better going forward. Welcome back to Speak for Yourself. Time now for a big story sponsored by KFC's $20 fill-up. Drive-thru's open or get delivery by Grubhub. Marcellus Wiley here. LeVar Arrington is back. And we're joined now by former Patriots offensive lineman Rich Orenberger. Let's talk Lamar Jackson, MVP, who got together with some of his teammates for a workout at a local park in Florida yesterday. Lamar is gearing up for another monster year, looking for a repeat of last year's MVP season, which won't be easy. Nobody's won back-to-back MVP since Peyton Manning more than a decade ago, and it's only happened 5 times ever. Peyton did it twice, joined by Brett Favre, Joe Montana, and Jim Brown. Now, that's a list. Rich, you like Lamar's chances to repeat as MVP?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is the most entertaining man in football right now. Lamar Jackson is must-watch television. But besides that, he made significant exponential statistical improvement from year one to year two. And he was asked to do a lot more. He was asked to prove us that he can keep a defense honest with his arm. He was able to do that. And also, think about this offseason. We're going to have an abbreviated offseason, which means that offenses aren't going to be able to gel as much. So the improvisers are going to reign supreme here this next NFL season. I can't wait to see what he pulls out of the hat. Marshall Yonder, the right guard, he's going to be a future Hall of Famer, but he retires. And while the rest of the league is also going to have some issues again with the shortened offseason to get their guys up front to gel, he's really going to thrive in that situation because he can extend play. He can obviously get outside the pocket and create. So I'm high on Lamar Jackson. I think he wins the MVP in 2020.
Whew. Man, you build a great case right there. But I got to disagree with you. Despite everything you said, which was accurate, I mean, you nailed it. The problem is not going to be Lamar Jackson's performance. It's going to be these damn voters with their narratives that they love to insert into performance. You're going to hear somebody who's older, like we saw with Drew Brees a couple years ago. Aaron Rodgers returning back to his greatest form, and at the age of 37, oh my God, or someone who's doing tremendous community service and playing well. And on top of that, you still got to deal with a Kyler Murray who's emerging, or a Patrick Mahomes who's always going to be in the conversation. I don't trust the voters. I trust Lamar Jackson is finally going to hit the deep outside the numbers route. He's going to continue to evolve. He's going to be great. If this was merit-based, absolutely. But because the conversation has morphed into more of a likability following social media with the button of what you like, I think the voters are going to get this one wrong, and they're going to vote Lamar Jackson out of it.
Well, I mean, that's a fair point, and I completely agree with you that all MVP voting, and this isn't just in the NFL, this is in the NBA as well. It's a popularity contest. I mean, was Westbrook really the MVP that year? Was he the flavor of the year? You know, I mean, you could look at James Harden and talk the same way. Was he the most valuable player, or was he the most popular, right? LeBron James, to my eyes, many of the years other candidates won, was the league's MVP. But back to the NFL, we see these things happen as well. Occasionally you have an issue where a guy catches fire at the right time. He catches the voters' eyes at the right time, and he can really make a run. It's almost like a political campaign. And here we are talking about electors, right? You know, it really is an interesting point you raised. But again, greatness wins. And what I'm seeing with Lamar Jackson year over year is budding, building incredible greatness. And I cannot wait to see what he comes up with in 2020. And go a step further. Talk about offensive coordinator Greg Roman. The work that he's done curtailing an offense to Lamar Jackson. You got the chef in the kitchen with his sous chef for another year together. They're going to do some magnificent cooking.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And listen, defenses generally close down the gap on what people's success is after they have enough time to prepare for them. But in a conversation, I was on the phone with actually doing a Skype call with Ryan Kerrigan was on and was talking about Lamar Jackson as one of the guys that he felt was, it's just insane how amazing he's able to do the things that he does on the field. And it made me start thinking to myself, you know, you may be able to draw up the right defensive schemes and everything is what it's supposed to be in the practice, but you can't simulate what you're going to see Lamar Jackson do on Sunday. I don't care who you put. You can get your best receiver to run quarterback. You can get, you know, your best running back to do it. But what it is that you're going to see on Sunday against a guy like Lamar Jackson, it's not going to be simulated available. So I still think that he has at least 1 to 2 more years before defenses figure him out in a way where you would say maybe he has to adjust or adapt to what the defenses are giving him. But we saw this with Mike Vick, and I think that Lamar Jackson is, if not just as good, maybe more electrifying than Mike Vick was, and they didn't catch up to him for a while.
Lamar Jackson or the field? I'm taking the field. It's not because of Lamar Jackson. It's because I have more opportunities over there. There are more storylines, and the pendulum must swing. MVP is a rotating trophy. If you think about it, Kobe Bryant, rest in peace. LeBron James, even Michael Jordan, there were times you're like, who are they giving it to? And it's because they have to find something else of interest. They get bored with the same story like we all do. And now you're talking about a social media age. Don't forget, Peyton Manning did it in 2008. Right now in 2020, when every single throw will be analyzed and criticized, and then it will just live out there in cyberspace for everyone to digest to the point of normalcy. And then to the point of, we expect that, kind of getting bored with that. What's the new trick? And that's when it's going to open up an opportunity for someone else. We saw Russell Wilson have an amazing year last year, but he came into the conversation And then they didn't want him to leave the conversation, even though he was performing himself out the conversation, because they hitched their wagon to that narrative. So we have to be very careful about the popularity element that is always a part of this conversation.